is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, November 1st, 2024, and today will be better than yesterday. I'm Buster Only, working from my home in Montana. A couple days after the end of the World Series, Taylor Schwenk is working from the Schwenk Studios. And Taylor, I think you and I know who, you know, at the end of the World Series, you know, there's some relief, I think, for folks who cover the sport. You know, the long season is over. But for one person we know very well, it's a super sad day, and that would be one Sarah Langs.
Some would call it her personal national nightmare. Like, she is such a baseball addict that the day that there's no more Major League Baseball, she is like clawing at the wall. She doesn't know what to do with herself. She's going to the Dominican League. And if what happens if that gets rains out, Buster? What's she going to do then? I don't know.
I know. Well, we're going to be talking with Sarah today, as well as Paul Imbakides and Todd Radom. And we got to find out from Sarah what she's doing now that the World Series has ended. You know, people for years and years and years, the standard for the title of who loves baseball the most, it was always Tim Kirkjian, right? Mm-hmm. But I think Sarah Langs. I think Tim would be the first to say, no, Sarah loves baseball more than I do.
Yeah, Tim's watching basketball at night. Right. He loves football. Yeah, Sarah is she's a baseball girly through and through. She loves it the most. Title to her.
Well, we're going to ask her later today how she's handling these days now that don't have Major League Baseball, the first days after the World Series. The business of the offseason started very quickly. The Atlanta Braves traded outfielder Jorge Soler to the Angels for right-handed pitcher Griffin Canning. We know this. Alex Anthopoulos, the head of baseball operations for the Braves, he does not wait. He moves very quickly early in the offseason to fill holes and make deals. And this was a deal. They shed Soler's salary, $13 million in each of the next year, 2 years, and they pick up some depth for the rotation, which has some questions around it. Bob Costas announced that he's retiring from baseball play-by-play after 42 years. What an amazing career that he had. Rays shortstop Wander Franco begins his sexual abuse trial on December 12th. It's an open question about whether or not he's going to play in the big leagues again. His former team, the Tampa Bay Rays, are trying to figure out what's going on with Tropicana Field. The city approved $6.5 million to clean up the field and to continue to assess whether or not games can be played there or when they can be played there as we move forward. Athletics owner John Fisher and his family will invest $1 billion into the construction of a stadium in Las Vegas, while U.S. Bank and Goldman Sachs will offer a $300 million loan, according to club executive Sandy Dean on Thursday. We'll see if that actually turns out to be true. And then this, Alex Kirilloff, a former top prospect for the Minnesota Twins, announced he's going to retire. He turns 27 next week. He wrote that over the course of his 9 professional seasons, he's had numerous injuries, which have led him to search for new ways to overcome the pain. And he wrote that these challenges have taken a toll on me mentally and physically. So Alex Kirilloff retiring at age 26. Taylor, what else you got?
Buster, let's look ahead here. So we've got a fun show ahead. We got Hembo. We got Todd. We got Sarah. We're going to be back. So we're going to be in our off-season cadence officially next week. We'll be back on Thursday afternoon. We're going to talk to Jeff Passan, possibly Hembo.
Tuesday again. Afternoon.
Oh, my
Tuesday
God. Afternoon. I've already bought Buster. This is a bad day for me. Behind the scenes, there's been a lot of poking fun at Taylor Schwenk, rightfully so, for you know, some silly slip-ups here and there. But we'll be back on Tuesday with Jeff Passan. And then we'll go once a week, but if there's, you know, big news, we're liable to drop in for sure.
Oh yeah. We certainly did last year when Shohei Ohtani wound up signing out his huge contract with the Dodgers. And we know what happened after that. We just saw it out on the field of Yankee Stadium the other day.
Yeah. Yeah. We also, I think the totally random string here, 2 off seasons ago when all the shortstops were up, I think we did an emergency pod for each of those shortstops when they chose their destination. So big time free agents, big news. We'll be with you.
Jumping into the numbers. This is Hembo Knows on Baseball Tonight.
Well, we got it done. Take 3 on Hembo's open, Hembo. What do you think?
Usually we board the plane a little bit better, but perhaps the hit will go better than the on-ramp.
Well, Taylor was definitely celebrating with Dodger fans, Taylor, after they won the World Series the other day, right?
No way. How dare you? My wife's a Yankees fan. I would never.
Oh, okay. Anyway, Hembo, so tell me, what'd you think of the World Series?
So a little bit anticlimactic, candidly, to use that word again in this podcast. Like, obviously, this is a matchup sort of coming into it. I kept saying it has all the makings. Like, it had all of the ingredients for it to be like this absolutely delicious, memorable, you know, 2001, 2011 type World Series that we just remember forever, because in this case, it's all these protagonists, the two sort of trademark franchises in the sport, the MVPs, all the stuff. I guess no one let the Yankees know that it was supposed to be that. I wouldn't describe it as a dud by any means. The games actually were quite compelling for a variety of reasons. I thought that the television ratings would be a little bit higher than they were, and perhaps that the drama would be a little bit greater. But in the end, it's hard to consider what happened as anything other than a triumph for baseball. It capped off what I thought was an absolutely tremendous season, although I do feel like the World Series in its totality did leave just a little bit of meat on the bone.
Yeah, because, Ohtani wasn't that great, and Aaron Judge wasn't that great. You know, he struggled at the beginning of it, and then he hit a home run at the end, and then he dropped the fly ball in a big moment. I don't think either one of these teams is being great teams. Like, I don't think we're going to talk about them as being teams that are going to go down in history, you know, with the 27 Yankees or the 76 Reds or, you know, the 98 Yankees. I thought they were, you know, two teams that, you know, got to the end kind of like two salmon that swam upstream and were completely beaten up and battered and in pieces right at the end. And it was the Dodgers who survived. I mean, the Yankees could have easily been up 3-2, which is why some of the narratives that are out there about, well, that this was a master, you know, class by the Dodgers, and the, you know, they knew the Yankees would make a lot of mistakes. It's like, oh, come on. Really? You're counting on Aaron Judge to miss a fly ball, his first fly ball in 18 months? The Dodgers win. They have a lot of great players. But at the end of the year, their rotation was in tatters. We're sitting there in the fifth inning wondering if Dave Roberts is going to have enough pitching to get through game 5 of the World Series. Right? These were not super teams.
Most definitely not. And I want to take that baton that you just handed me and run with it just a little bit, because I continue to see in a variety of different places, not just one place or a few places, like all over the place, that somehow the fifth inning of game 5 was emblematic or symbolic of Yankee shortcomings. And Buster, I have to admit, like, I just don't see it that way at all. I mean, Aaron Judge had played 1,100 errorless innings in the outfield during the season. Anthony Volpe has 21 defensive runs saved in 2 seasons and was the American League Gold Glove shortstop last year. Gerrit Cole has practiced that PFP in his life 10,000 times. Like, the idea that the Yankees are somehow fatally built as with those plays as being the sort of prism through which we view them, to me, is totally faulty. That's a play that Aaron Judge makes 99 out of 100 times. It's a play that Anthony Volpe makes probably 19 out of 20 times. And it's a play that Gerrit Cole probably makes 49 out of 50 times. And it just so happened to come at the worst possible time in the same inning. That's baseball. That's baseball season, yes, as they like to say, right? And so in my judgment, what happened to the Yankees in the fifth inning of that game is not symbolic or emblematic. It's just baseball. It's the beauty of baseball. And the idea that Brian Cashman or Aaron Boone should somehow wear it, in my judgment at least, is completely and utterly ridiculous.
Yeah, there's a random nature to all this in every game, right? Which is, it's not as if the Dodgers were sitting there in this great plan and this great, they had the answers to everything. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been in jeopardy of being down 3-2 in the World Series, which, again, could have easily happened. And I agree with you. That part of our industry really drives me crazy. A couple places I saw yesterday where it was, you know, the Yankees are a disaster, their brand of baseball is a disaster. They just led the American League in wins. They wound up winning the American League playoffs. And as we said, they played well enough for most of this World Series where they could have, there's a path through which they could have easily been ahead in this World Series, but they played, you know, and they had that ugly fifth inning and Freddie Freeman was great.
Yeah. The championship or bust prism through which a lot of people view all things, in my opinion, at least, Buster, is ludicrous. And that's because 1 out of 30 teams gets to win the championship.
Right.
And even though Yankee fans of yesteryear had the luxury of winning far more frequently than they have lately, that doesn't guarantee you anything now. And the fact that the Yankees came three wins shy of winning the championship, to me, is not a failure. It is a triumph. It is farther than the Yankees have gotten since 2009. And there are all sorts of reasons why they did so. And some of them are obviously positive in their favor. And some of them are the fact that the American League and the league at large was a little bit watered down this season. And they capitalized on it. Like, for a variety of reasons and a variety of factors, I think contributed to where the Yankees are. But I think with the benefit of time and hindsight, Yankee fans should be able to look back on this season as one in which they candidly exceeded expectations, or at least met them. And the notion that there's some fatal flaw in their formula based on the fifth inning of game five and based on the, you know, walk-off homer in game one, obviously, is just not a fair thing to do. It's just not, it's an easy thing for fans to overreact to. And I get it. I'm a fan too. But in reality, when it comes to evaluating this stuff objectively, the Yankees just had a marvelous season and we should sort of reward them for it.
And the Dodgers, I think, played better generally in the World Series, right?
That team could really hit. They could really, really hit. That was the difference-making. This Dodgers team, in a year in which pitching dominated, as you talked about at length throughout the postseason, a year in which the pitching dominated hitting throughout baseball season and throughout the postseason, the team with the best lineup was bound to win, and that was clearly and obviously the Dodgers.
Yep. Hembo, do you think the Dodgers are positioned to be dynastic?
As much as any team can be, but obviously in baseball, I'm not sure at least anytime soon we'll see one that approximates the dynasties of yesteryear. Let's remember, it's a 98-win team this season, which was two fewer than last, 13 fewer than 2022, and eight fewer than 2021. The Dodgers just won the World Series with their worst team since the last time that they won the World Series by that standard of measure. Now, if you look at this team over the next, we'll call it two or three years, they're obviously going to be very well positioned to be the favorite every year, because Shohei Ohtani's only going to count $46 million against their books. And if he's a two-way player the way that we've expected him to become, of course, he's probably going to be twice that valuable. And it's hard to imagine this team regressing from a run prevention standpoint. The Dodgers are going to prevent runs in the future, immediate future, a lot better than they did this season and probably last. And so they're going to be in on Roki Sasaki. They're probably going to be in on any number of other free agents to shore up their pitching staff. And from that standpoint, I think the Dodgers are going to be better. The Dodgers are going to win 100 games basically every year, or be projected to in the future. But the nature of baseball's postseason now, Buster, as you well know, almost guarantees that we're not going to have a dynasty the way that we most recently saw the Yankees in the late 90s.
And I'd say this too. I already regard the Dodgers as a dynasty. Hmm. Like, with how they've dominated the National League West. Now, if winning championships has to be, you know, part of that definition, then I get it if you were to push back on that point. I look at the Atlanta Braves teams, you know, from, you know, over 15 years, they dominated the National League East. They were in the playoffs every year. They gave themselves a chance to win the World Series every year. Right. I know that they don't necessarily have a lot of championships, but I look at that team, consistent success as being dynastic. Think about all the Hall of Famers that were on those teams.
Yeah, I think that's a well-made point, Buster. Let's stop down on that for just a second. Kansas basketball would be a good example. They win the Big 12 every single year, but then they enter this 68-team tournament and they only win it like once every 6 or 8 years, because that's right. The nature of the sport. Look, if we had rounds of playoffs in the 50s, the way that we do now, the Yankees wouldn't have won the World Series every year. That's just the nature of the beast. And so fans need to understand that the game is so different now. Even the Yankees that won the World Series so often in the late 90s, they're dealing with four teams that are making the playoffs from their league. And now we've nearly doubled that output. There are two more teams. There are more layers to this stuff. You have to consider how many teams are in the league and how many rounds of playoffs that you need to win. And baseball, more than any other sport, Buster, is one in which if you're playing good teams, 60-40 is the most that you could ever be favored by. And so all you can do if you're running a team is position yourself to win your division every single year, as the Dodgers have and as the Dodgers will.
And I think that was one of the points that Billy Beane was trying to make in Moneyball, right? The famous line, you know, our crap doesn't work in the postseason. I think he took it too far specifically, but I would have felt the same way about the Dodgers as we're talking about with the Yankees. If the Dodgers had lost this World Series, I'd be like, yeah, but the year was a success, right? They wound up being the best team in the National League. They put themselves in a position to have a shot at it. And when random series of events are applied in these close games in October, they wound up prevailing, right? I mean, who would have known Freddie Freeman was going to step up and hit home runs in each of the, you know, first four games of the World Series and be as spectacular as he was? You just don't know. Who would have known? Does anyone think that the Dodgers mapped it out at the beginning of the year or even the beginning of the World Series that Walker Buehler was going to throw the last pitches in the World Series. That wasn't part of their master plan, okay? So I that's, you know, to go back to the idea that a lot of this has some randomness to it. All right, let's go through the as you know already, the conversation's big around Juan Soto. I absolutely thought the other day how he handled his postgame press conference was exactly what I think we would have expected, because that's what Gerrit Cole did, who's also, when he became a free agent, also a client of Scott Boras. And you remember when Gerrit Cole came out to meet with reporters, he was wearing a Scott Boras Corp cap, okay? And we're all left to interpret that. And that's kind of what Juan Soto was doing the other day. Hey, I'm ready to talk to everybody.
Yeah, he's played the game perfectly. I will say this. He's a perfect Yankee, and Yankee fans love that guy. I mean, Yankee fans like a lot of their guys. Yankee fans love that guy. There's something about Juan Soto in the right, in playing right field in that ballpark with those fans that I think especially just works. But it's not going to matter to Scott Boras. What's going to matter to Scott Boras and what's going to matter to Juan Soto is the dollar figure. You don't get to a point, Buster, where you turn down a $440 million contract from the team that brought you up and developed you like he did in Washington unless your objective is to reach free agency, which he finally has. And the Yankees have had a one-year exclusive negotiating window, and here we are. This has always been the objective. He obviously wants to win. He obviously wants to be an all-time great, and he also wants to set record with the contract that he's going to sign, and he's going to because he's an all-time great player. There's no question, though, that Scott Boras and Juan Soto have played this thing like a fiddle, and he is going to be an incredibly rich man for not only sort of performing the way that he has. I think he's a top 100 player of all time already, potentially trending towards being a top 50. I mean, this guy's ridiculously good and everyone knows it, but he's also going to break barriers when it comes to the new contract that I think people are going to make. It's going to make their head spin. It's one thing to see Ohtani get 700 because he's a two-way unicorn. The dollar figure that Juan Soto is going to get, you're going to see football players around the country flummox when they see that number for the first time.
You think the Yankees are in a precarious position?
Very much so, because not only have the Yankees gone through this exclusive negotiating window with Juan Soto to no avail, they're obviously in no better position than anyone else is, aside from just having the, you know, sort of high stakes experience of having him for a year. So I suppose they have proof of concept, but they also have this Gerrit Cole situation on their hands, Buster. And that's not something that people are talking about enough. Gerrit Cole can opt out of his contract, as you well know, and the Yankees, if they want to keep him, have to add a 10th year to his contract, and that'll take us through the 2020s, and that might well be their best option. But are you sitting here and telling me you're going to offer Gerrit Cole that much money into the future?
Potentially $180 million. It would be $180 million over 5 years.
And that's $180 million then that you're not offering or spending on Juan Soto. It's a very challenging position in which to be, and that's why I thought the Yankees should have traded Gerrit Cole before the season started, and people laughed at me, and people are still laughing at me. But Juan Soto is an all-time great. Gerrit Cole is a really good pitcher who's going to, you know, continue to age, obviously, and theoretically, at least the older he gets, the more his health might be in jeopardy. And he had his first sort of big health scare this year, and he sort of got through it, but he wasn't the Gerrit Cole of old. I mean, if I'm the Yankees, the only thing that matters this offseason is retaining Juan Soto. And if that means that I lose Gerrit Cole for nothing more than a compensation pick, Buster, I'm more than willing to do that.
It's why, and we talked a little bit about this on the podcast yesterday. I talked about it with Jess and Eduardo in the clown car. I don't think it's a slam dunk how the Yankees are going to handle this. People have talked about it as if, yeah, you know, Gerrit Cole's going to opt out, and yeah, the Yankees will void that opt out by giving him the extra year. You're talking about a pitcher, you know, who's in his mid 30s now. Who I mean, we don't know all the information about his elbow. The Yankees have it. Gerrit Cole has it. You know, they both know the true nature of what's going on in there. You would expect, with so many pitchers having elbow injuries, that there's a fair chance that he's going to miss a significant amount of the time over the next 5 years. I don't think it's as much of a slam dunk as what people say.
I don't either, Buster. He's going to pitch next season at 34 years old. The Yankees already have Aaron Judge on the books. It's a huge contract. Carlos Rodon, the exact same contract, by the way, that Freddie Freeman signed. Giancarlo Stanton has more years left. DJ LeMahieu. The Yankees are not in a position where, at least by their standards, they can just spend willy-nilly. Like, honestly, I'm saying this honestly. If Gerrit Cole opted out and the Yankees elected not to exercise that 10th year option, that's the best thing for the franchise. I know you wind up letting him walk for next to nothing, but I don't know that paying Gerrit Cole through his 30s is a wise, that's not a get to, that's a have to, especially if it comes at the expense of offering Juan Soto $180 more dollars than you might be able to otherwise. Buster, you've made this point before, so let me know if I'm not characterizing it properly. But Brian Cashman was not all gung-ho about 9 for $360 when it came to Aaron Judge. That was at least in part a Hal Steinbrenner decision. So the idea that Brian Cashman is going to be comfortable giving Juan Soto between $600 and $700 million, which is what I think it will cost, would strike me as unlikely, at least based on that precedent. You know, that's going to have to be an ownership decision if we're talking about spending that much money. And for me, I want to clear all of my books as much of whatever I can to ensure that Judge and Soto are in the middle of my lineup for as long as Aaron Judge is still in his prime.
Yeah, I mean, I'll put it this way. First off, and maybe next week when we have you back on, we can try to assess the potential value that Soto, if you sign him to a long-term deal, his potential win value is to the Yankees before. As you say, that should be, as we move forward, that should be the priority over getting the age 34 through 38 seasons over Gerrit Cole. You know what I mean?
By a long shot.
And you know, and here's the other thing, too. If I have a lineup that starts with Aaron Judge and Juan Soto, and I don't have Gerrit Cole. You know, let's say he says, I want to opt out. I want to test the market. And the Yankees go, okay, go ahead. If I'm the Yankees, I feel like I can go and find another pitcher. I can't go and get another Juan Soto necessarily.
Buster, there's only one kind of player right now in the game of baseball worth paying a gazillion dollars to. And that is a hitter with the kind of profile that Juan Soto has. It has never been easier to put together innings than it is right now. I just saw the Detroit Tigers reach game 5 of the American League Division Series with one starting pitcher. The Yankees have infinitely more resources than they do. They can find innings. They can find outs. It's the easiest thing to do. There's a billion pitching labs that can produce swing and miss pitchers right now, and teams across baseball are capitalizing on that. But there's like 5 people on the planet that can approximate what Juan Soto can do at the plate. It's the stickiest skill, and it's not a skill that you're worried about health-wise year to year. There is no question, Buster, that Juan Soto is infinitely more valuable to the short and long-term future of the New York Yankees than Gerrit Cole is.
You and I think, believe the same thing, that the most likely place for Soto to land are the New York Mets. Tell me why.
Well, because Steve Cohen owns the team and he's worth $20 billion. And so $650 million to him is not going to be $650 million than it would be to Hal Steinbrenner or Brian Cashman. And we just saw this team pay Justin Verlander and Max Scherzer $62 million this year not to pitch for them. Money is not going to be an object. And so I have a hard time. Look, my mother-in-law works in real estate. She often uses the term highest and best. The Mets offer is going to be highest and best. The question is, how close is the Yankees offer and how close is anyone else's offer?
I completely agree with you on that. Two more before you go. What do you think Freddie Freeman's place in history is? Who else from the past is in his neighborhood and accomplishments? Because the more that I think about what he's done and now putting this, you know, World Series, which will be held up at his induction ceremony in Cooperstown as the apex of his career, you know, where would you sort of put him in baseball history?
So his career arc is one that reminds me of Adrian Beltre's. That might seem like an odd comparison, Buster, because they obviously don't play the same position and they're not even all that similar a player. But the reason I think Adrian Beltre is a great comp is because Adrian Beltre was ageless. He just kept getting better. Adrian Beltre in his 20s was good. Adrian Beltre in his 30s was great. Freddie Freeman, since turning 30 years old, has a 153 OPS plus, 17% better than it was in his 20s. And Freddie Freeman, for my money at least, has the best, most replicable swing in baseball. The most replicable swing in baseball, pole to pole, gap to gap, that is going to age very well through his 30s should he choose to play that long. And the low demand, relatively speaking, of playing first base should allow him to do it. His body doesn't look any different than it used to. The swing is as replicable as it used to be. I think Freddie Freeman has a chance to be the last hitter to ever reach 3,000 hits and go down as something like a top 10 to 12 first baseman of all time. And given the fact that he's playing on a Dodgers team, of course, that's loaded and is likely to be moving forward, his hardware case, Buster, is going to be really filled up. Like, that Zoom background behind him is going to be awfully gold and awfully impressive. But I happen to think that Freddie Freeman, so long as he continues to age gracefully, is going to wind up going down as an all-time great. That's not something I would have predicted 5 years ago.
He needs about 800 more hits, or just shy of that, to get to 3,000 hits. I agree with you. I think there are going to be fewer and fewer of those guys as we move forward. And lastly, Walker Buehler threw the last pitch of the World Series. He wins game three as a starting pitcher. He gets the save in game five. How much money do you think he made himself in free agency? Because I think, you know, we always talk about how small sample size in baseball doesn't matter as much. I think in his case, it might.
So, I agree with you, actually. So on one hand, I would say to anyone listening, don't overpay for the small sample size. Don't overpay for the thing that you just saw. On the other hand, that was just affirmation of the pitcher that we know he was. I mean, in 2021, he led the major leagues in ERA plus in 33 starts. We saw him across the 2019 and 2020 postseasons absolutely dominate. And so it's not as if what we saw at the end here was just a spasm of greatness. We saw Walker Buehler be that in a significant period of time before the injury. And so I think that there's no player this year that has made himself more money than what he would have otherwise been beforehand than he was in the postseason. Walker Buehler just made himself gobs and gobs of money in the playoffs, and he wasn't even good in the regular season. There was a non-zero chance that he was going to get left off the playoff roster at one point. So I would say that that guy guaranteed himself a multi-year contract and millions of dollars that he would have not gotten otherwise. The last point I'll make, Buster, is this. The Dodgers' offer to him will tell us everything we need to know about Walker Buehler. The Dodgers have more information, terabytes of information on that guy. And if they let him walk and let him do his own thing, I think that will be a good sign to the rest of the league that maybe there's stuff about him, physically or otherwise, that we don't know, and perhaps we should be careful. The Dodgers offer him a big contract. I think it will be proof positive that Walker Buehler is going to have a really successful second act after the surgery.
We talked about how Sean Manaea really made himself a lot of money by altering his delivery on the fly in the midst of the year. Walker Buehler did the same thing. When we had him on a Sunday night game, and Dave Roberts basically said to us, look, he's got to learn that he can't just bully hitters. He's got to do a, you know, more mix in different pitches. And guess what? Over the next 6 weeks, he did that. He was significantly better as he made these adjustments. And I think, as you say, given his history, if you're an interested team, you can feel pretty good about the chances he'll continue on that trajectory. All right, Hembo, hey, thanks for doing this. Always fun.
Later, friends.
0096.
This is The Numbers Game with Sarah Langs.
Sarah Langs, reporter, producer for MLB.com. Sarah, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Buster. But on Thursday, our first day without MLB baseball, it was raining in the DR, and there were no league dome games. It was very, very upsetting. We had rain out, so there was no baseball at all for me to watch. Hopefully it's sunny there tonight.
That's what I was thinking. You probably did check out the Winter League schedule like right away, as soon as the World Series ended the other night, to see what you could grab onto, yes?
Oh, of course. I mean, after the World Series end, I always watch every league dome game. They're on MLB.TV, really easy to get to. I love watching them. And then I tuned in yesterday, and I see a tarp, and I'm like, no, this must be a joke.
Not fair. The baseball gods, not fair. All right, Sarah, I want you to join the parade of people who are giving predictions on Juan Soto. Where do you think he's going to sign, and what do you think the final number is going to be?
My goodness. I mean, any team will be lucky to have him. We all know that. Having seen the way the Yankee families embraced him all year, I remember the first thing we went to this season, seeing the way they chirped him, we trotted out to right field, the way, I mean, even in the roll call, they seem extra excited about him. I really think that he will remain a New York Yankee. I think that fan base and the Yankee fans so embrace. We'll see. But I'm going to paint the Yankees. That's from the numbers. I think it will be in the 600 million.
Wow.
We'll see. But again, I mean, this is the greatest player of this age we've seen, certainly in our lifetime, and you've seen how valuable he can be. So that's what I'm thinking.
Man, and that would be a couple winters after they gave Aaron Judge $360 million, okay? So there are a couple ways to look at that. One, if he does get $600 million, then they would increase and they're offered to Soto by about 67% more than what they gave to Judge. Now, he's Soto is a much younger free agent than Judge was, so that's one major factor. Man, and almost $1 billion committed to two players, Sarah. That would be amazing. You know, and I guess that's going to be the case. It's kind of like last winter when the Dodgers invested, you know, in actual present day dollars, $461 million in Shohei Ohtani, and then gave $325 million to Yoshinobu Yamamoto.
Exactly. Look how that turned out for them. Pretty well. I mean, I don't know what they said is realistic, but I do mean there is a chance of that number with whatever team he does end up with.
Yeah, well, and Soto seems to have taken a page out of Aaron Judge's book. When Aaron Judge became a free agent, it felt like nobody really knew what he wanted in his heart, right? Was it to go back to San Francisco? Was it to go to a different team? Was it return to the Yankees? And in the end, in those last hours before he agreed to terms, he told the Yankees, you know what, I want to go back to the Yankees. I don't want to play, you know, with San Diego or San Francisco. And maybe it takes these negotiations to reveal that. And maybe Juan Soto doesn't know at this moment, you know, what exactly he wants, because he doesn't know what all the specifics of these offers are going to be. All right, let's play the numbers game.
Number three
is five. So we have to talk about game one and the 5-1 comeback that the Dodgers had. Jim Clancy was it. That is the largest comeback by any team in the game where they clinched a World Series title. And it wasn't just the 5-1 comeback. They were the first team in postseason history in any game to fall behind by at least 1 run, raise that deficit, and then fall behind again and still win the game. No team had ever done that in the playoffs. And they did it in their clincher. Just an amazing comeback from them.
Yeah, they just keep coming at you.
Number two
is two. For the, you know, two stats on the back of the baseball card from Walker Buehler in this World Series. And the win as a starter, and he had the same in the World Series. He is the fourth guy. The Saves became a final in 1979. Then we went as a starter and the same in the same World Series. The other ones were, of course, Madison Bumgarner in 2014, and then Catfish Hunter in 1974, and Jack Mellingham in 1972. For Walker Buehler, it was his first save in the major, in the regular season or the postseason. He won in the minors in 2017, about 25 days before he was called up to the majors. And he had won in college for your Vanderbilt, Buster, on May 11th, 2013. He had a 3-inning save in the game that ended 11-3. That was his first save after he graduated high school.
Yeah, I love that note. I saw you put that out the other day, getting that save at Vanderbilt.
Number one
is also fun, because we have to talk about Will Smith. So last year we had the sad about Will Smith, the reliever, was the first guy to win the World Series in 3 straight years with 3 different teams. But if we go back to 2020, Will Smith, the catcher on the Dodgers, of course, won the World Series. That means that now in 5 straight seasons, we have had a Will Smith win the World Series. There's no context in this, except that baseball is amazing. And it's just so funny to think about someone named Will Smith has won the World Series in 5 straight seasons.
it'd be interesting in the spring training when we go back, when I go back to Arizona, having conversation with Will Smith about that. I suspect that'll be a really short conversation that he probably will look at me and go, yeah, okay. So it's a total random coincidence. What do you got? All right, Sarah. Well, thanks for doing this. I appreciate it as always.
Yeah,
And good luck. I hope the bad weather system clears out down in Winterball.
Thank you, Mother. Thank you so much for having me, not just today, but all year. I love doing this podcast with you, and thank you, Taylor, as well. It's just so much fun. It always brightens my day.
We always love having you, Sarah. Todd Radom is the chief executive of our weekly quiz. He's a graphic artist whose work can be seen on ball fields all across America or all around the world. Or you can go to his website, toddradom.com. Todd, how you doing?
Buster, I'm well. It's kind of sad. It's November. The baseball season's over. What are we going to do till March?
Well, you're going to think about Bart Giamatti's Greenfields of the Mind, which we're going to listen to in a bit. I know you had some thoughts on that before we talk about your experience at the World Series this week.
Yeah, Buster, inevitably, the Greenfields of the Mind, knowing that this is always the last word on the season podcast for you and for all of us, I'll look at it a couple of times a year, especially this time of year. And I can't help but think about the fact that, you know, he's talking about the last day of the 1977 Red Sox season. We know what the history is, what 78 brought. Bart Giamatti never lived to see 2004, much less three additional Red Sox World Series championships. But just, Buster, you're going to relate to this. It's also very dark, and it's about aging. And there's a lot to look at with Greenfields of the Mind.
Yeah. Well, how could I relate to the whole thing about aging? What are you talking about?
You're a week older than me, Buster.
Oh, there you go. All right. What was your experience at the World Series?
Yeah, so I went up to New York for Game 5, and a couple of things, Buster. It, just in retrospect, I can't help but think of the 2024 World Series, all the hype, all the star power aside, as being somewhat analogous in reverse, perhaps, to the 2018 World Series. Five games. The fifth game, Dave Roberts smells blood. He empties out the bullpen. They find a way to win, and he brings Walker Buehler in there, kind of like what Alex Cora did with Chris Sale to get the final outs. That was surprising. I was there in both cases. What do you think of that?
I agree. We were talking with Hembo about the idea, because now, as you, and I know you've been reading the stories in New York, it's like what happened to the World Series is a sign of everything that's wrong with the Yankees and the way that the Yankees team is built. And I'm reading a lot of it, and I'm like, first off, the Dodgers were the better team in the World Series. I think there's no question about that. But I'm also thinking to myself, the Yankees just led the American League in wins. And, you know, if Freddie Freeman doesn't hit a grand slam, and if Aaron Judge, who's a great, you know, has great hands, catches a fly ball, the Yankees could have easily been up 3-2 at that point. So I'm not ready to this sweeping, you know, casting of the Dodgers is everything they did turned out great, and everything the Yankees do stinks. I think baseball is much more random than that.
A game of inches, as the saying goes, and going back to 2018, that 18-inning game where Max Muncy walks it off in the middle of the night, basically. I was up for 24 hours straight for that thing, coming from New York earlier that day. Again, like you said, could have gone either way. Now, listen, that said, and this has been talked about ad infinitum, the Yankees' sloppiness is something that they experienced during the season. There are significant holes in that lineup.
Right.
And, you know, the Dodgers with Ohtani and seemingly a team of destiny bought and paid for. But we'll put that aside. But, it could have gone either way, but it didn't. And so to the victors belong the spoils, as we know.
I guess. Yeah. You're 100% right. And I'm thinking, too, like, we get to the Yankees win the American League. They win the first rounds of the playoffs in part because Aaron Judge, you know, and his greatness overall as a player. He's not a great outfielder. Like, he's not an extraordinary outfielder. Juan Soto is, as we've talked about, you know, many times, he's his generation's Ted Williams. He is not a great defender. You know, Anthony Rizzo now is in his mid 30s. He's not as good as he used to be. This is kind of who this team is. You could go through that same exercise on the flip side of this. I don't think anyone was thinking that the Dodgers necessarily would get to October with their pitching staff as fragmented as it was, but they found a way. And so I tend to think of it more as you celebrate the Dodgers for, you know, the effort of Freddie Freeman to play through injuries, for Walker Buehler for taking the ball in game five after starting in game three, which is not something anybody was mapping out.
And let's give credit where credit is due to Dave Roberts, who has got a fair share of abuse over the years. And you know, it's the Dodgers. Anybody could win with that. Buster, I happen to think that the 2020 World Series championship was just so bizarre, and him being able to navigate as a manager through all of that deserves more credit than he gets. And listen, it's been talked about in the last couple of days. He's 9-for-9 in postseason appearances. Okay, you're going to get in there. But he's got a couple of championships now, and his name might be mentioned. You probably would agree for the Hall of Fame as a manager when he's finished.
Yeah, he's going to wind up piling up some years. I mean, there's no end in sight. His contract runs out at the end of next year. I'm sure they'll be talking about an extension. And that's how you start to get attention. You accumulate a lot of years. You accumulate a lot of success in October. And in the end, you wind up getting a lot of support for the Hall of Fame. That's how it works. Yeah. Tell me about leaving Yankee Stadium the other day. You know, I understand, you know, you're there at a time. I mean, the Yankees have had so much success in their history against the Dodgers in Yankee Stadium, but this was something very different.
Yeah, I mean, and I will say this, Buster, between the old stadium and, of course, the new stadium, which is not so new anymore, only two World Series under its architectural belt. I've been going to World Series games in New York since the late 70s, all of them in the 90s and early 2000s. And seeing the number of Dodgers fans there celebrating while walking down those ramps, the seemingly eternal journey out of the ballpark in the wee hours, high-fiving. There was a vendor at a closed beer stand, Buster, who was spraying a bottle of beer on the Dodgers fans who were all over the place. Saw Andre Ethier in the hallway over there. The Dodgers fans were celebrating walking out of Yankee Stadium in the Bronx. And as you and I have spoken about before, the only time I have ever seen anything like that was in the aftermath of Game 7 of the 2004 American League Championship Series, when Red Sox fans took over that place, stayed there till the end, and overthrew all of the accumulated decades of curse and abuse. And all of that. It was really extraordinary to see, Buster.
So because of your long history of going to Yankee games, I'm going to ask you a question just to double check my own instincts and what I saw during games 3, 4, and 5 of the World Series. I'd never seen a Yankee crowd like that. They never turned on these guys in the moment, right? Aaron Judge was struggling so badly. And then going into game 3, they start chanting MVP during the first player introductions. They're standing every time he comes to the plate. It felt like they were trying to lift him up. I mean, it was stunning to me. Like the way the Yankee fans, they actually were demonstrating some empathy for Aaron Judge in a way that I had never seen before. Now, the day after they lost the World Series, you go online and it's a very different reaction. But in the ballpark, That was the most unusual Yankee crowd that I have ever seen. Am I wrong? Do you disagree with me?
I think it's a mixed bag, Buster. I don't think that crowd is ever going to turn on Aaron Judge because he's so great and they love him.
And they know he tries.
Personality. It's like Jeter, you know? He's right.
Well, they booed Jeter, though. They
did
Jeter
on occasion. But yeah. Listen, I heard a certain number of F-bombs being directed at Booney in the late innings. Yeah. I heard some griping, but I couldn't help but think of the fact that, Buster, there's an entire generation of Yankee fans that didn't grow up with a World Series appearance year after year after year. And listen, going up there, I had flashbacks to the fact that this was like an October ritual. You go to the Bronx for a playoff or a World Series game.
Right.
You take the day or the four train up there, or when I was younger, I would take it, you know, as a teenager down from the Bronx, from the North Bronx, from Woodlawn on the 4. And they haven't experienced that. So I think that there's pent-up demand and expectations that we just never would have witnessed up until the early 2000s. Let's put it that way.
All right. You have absolutely honored us this year with your Ballpark and Beyond episodes that we've had you on for. Tell me what your plans for that are going forward.
Well, Buster, if you are amenable and if ESPN extends my contract with my option for 2025
contract.
Yeah. Yeah. We signed it over pizza in Denver at the All-Star game in 2021. I would love to continue this segment. It's been very well received. I think it's open-ended. It really can be anything you want it to be in a certain sense. And it allows us baseball fans who are intellectually curious to explore the game off the field, perhaps. So I'd like to continue doing it moving forward.
I absolutely would love that. Taylor, what about you?
I'm into it. Yeah, I think this was probably, not that we don't always get great feedback from your segments, but the most universally hailed. And I like the way you just framed it. Like, it can kind of be anything. And I like that. And it leaves you lots of creative avenues to do what you do. So we appreciate it. And I can't wait to bring it back next season.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you so much, Todd. I look forward to that.
Guys, have a great off season. Let's be in touch. Get some rest. Thank you to all of our listeners, people who check in on social media every single week. And I'm feeling nostalgic. It's like the last day of camp.
Bleacher Tweets.
All righty, Buster. One more Bleacher Tweets for the 2024
season. Let's start
season.
Off with this, Taylor. Let's start with this. Let's thank our listeners for all the incredible feedback we got this year.
You beat me to it, man.
It was your idea. It was your idea to do these voicemails, which have turned out spectacularly. With the response that we've gotten from folks. And it's great to hear the voices of folks that in the past, you know, maybe dropped in on Twitter or sent an email or something like that. And we still like that, but these voicemails have been amazing.
Yeah, they've been awesome. It's great to just hear people. You know, it's, you know, when you interact with people on the internet, it's really can be one dimensional who you see that person is. So, you know, getting to hear some voices and some personality, even the email address, we've gotten some really good emails as well.
Super
so many. And honestly, I'll send some to you, Buster. We're not going to play. We got so many voicemails, so many emails after the World Series, everyone in their feels about baseball ending and just like what it means to them. And so many kind words about the show, which we definitely appreciate. I'll rattle off some names here real quick. Dave in Texas, Andrew in Astoria, Queens, Eric in Boston. He wrote that Greenfields of the Mind has a special place in his heart. John in Greenville, South Carolina, and an A's fan who's looking for a new team. Bruce in Jerusalem, who's written in a bunch. Those were just a couple people who wrote in, called in, that we won't play or read their stuff, but we really appreciate it. We try and do that as well.
Yeah. And I got to say that as I've gone around this postseason, I've been stopped by, you know, people who work in the industry. I've been stopped by fans, and saying how much they enjoy the podcast and love, you know, they'll parrot things back from the podcast. You know, someone yelled out at me the other day, Bitter Boulevard.
Yes. Oh my God. That's amazing.
Yeah. And so it's super cool. And again, thank you so much to our listeners.
Absolutely. We will again solicit your opinions on the show. Now that we have this email inbox open, that'll be super helpful. You know, we're always trying to improve and do things a little bit better. Let's do a couple voicemails here. We didn't talk a ton about the guys who tried to rip the ball out of Mookie Betts' hand, but we got a really good voicemail on it. So we don't have to spend a ton of time on that subject, but here we go.
Yes, this is Beverly Parker in Nashville, Tennessee. I just want to say, shame on those fans who interfere with Mookie Betts and trying to take his glove in that ball. They ought to get more severe punishment than just being banned for one game. Talk to you soon. Thanks.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I was actually surprised that the Yankees didn't like step up and make a big statement about, you know, how that's unacceptable. But yeah. I think this whole episode is very interesting because it reflected, as I've used this phrase on the show before, the confederacy that is Major League Baseball, that basically, rather than, you know, Major League Baseball coming down and saying the fans are kicked out, they're banned for 10 years or whatever the number would be, right, and have a dictum. The first story was Major League Baseball asked the Yankees to address this. Now, the Yankees did a great thing. You know, they had a young fan who was coming back from pediatric cancer who they gave the seats to, and that was super nice. But there was no announcement about whether or not these season ticket holders would be banned for a year or 2 years or 10 years. It's almost like they just wanted to go away. And you're like, man, it was a great opportunity for the Yankees, for Major League Baseball. But you know, so far, as far as we know, those fans are going to be let back in beginning of next year.
I don't want to be dramatic. Mookie Betts was assaulted in the workplace. Like he really could have been hurt. My first thought was like his arm is going to get like crushed on the corner of, you know, the railing or whatever it was. Like it really looked, you know, I know everyone had a laugh about it, but my first thought was like, this is a really dangerous situation. So, yeah, interesting stuff, but great call from Nancy. Very,
yep.
You know, we love, to hear from Nancy in Nashville. One more voicemail here. We got to end it with the voicemails with our guy, Landon.
Hey guys, this is Landon from Atlanta. I want to thank both of y'all for another phenomenal season of the Baseball Tonight podcast. The work you guys do on a weekly basis is something that doesn't go unnoticed for me and several other fans on here. Then Buster, to close out the season, I would like to know a prediction for the off season or next season that you are most confident in, whether it could be Soto going to the Mets, or even the Dodgers repeating as World Series champs next year. I'd just love to hear something, a prediction that you have for myself and the audience. Thank you guys again.
A prediction.
I got one.
Okay, go ahead, Taylor. You've given more thought about this than I have. I'm going to defer to you.
The Dodgers will win the NL West again.
What kind of, that?
He said, what you're confident in. I'm confident in that.
That is lame. That is a lame prediction. I think he wanted a bold prediction of some kind.
Ooh,
right? I mean, I want to hear from you. I'd pronounce right now, next year, the Orioles are going to win the World Series. I mean, I want you to make that prediction right now.
I'm going to predict that the Orioles aren't going to re-sign Anthony Santander, and it'll make me sad.
That's just to be clear, that's Taylor's version of a bold prediction. Yeah, all right. Yeah. Oh, man. Right. Well, Landon, thank you so much for the nice voicemail.
We love you, Landon. Two tweets here. Danny Hess, Bearded Wonder 8 writes, and I knew my Dodgers were going to win as soon as Buster picked the Yankees. Thanks, Buster. We owe it all to you. Spence, Texas baseball fan, since the World Series is over, let's talk about where Tampa Bay plays next year while the Trop is being repaired during the next half of the season. Would love to see Major League Baseball retrofit, a college football stadium, AAA stadium. They're playing and they want to play in the area. Do you know anything about what's going on with that?
Well, I know that, the Yankees, of course, have Steinbrenner Field. You could theoretically do it there. You could play in St. Pete if you wanted to. You know, Raymond they got James, a ballpark maybe? There.
Yeah,
but here's the thing. Every person I talk to about this reminds me of this, who lives down in Florida. From 3:30 to 5:30 every day, it rains. Like, you can set your watch by it, right?
Yeah.
So you need a field that could, A, drain, and B, you have to figure out if you're going to have an open-air ballpark, what you're going to do with all the rain, which is why I do wonder if in the end, and this is speculation, if the best place for them to go for 2025 is Miami and share that ballpark down with the Marlins.
Interesting.
You know, they've got a roof, and that's the practical reality of baseball in Florida.
Damn, Buster. This is why you listen to the end of the podcast, everyone. He's talking about drainage. I haven't heard anyone propose the sharing of Miami for the Rays next year, so... There we go. We're at the end of Bleacher Tweets. Sean Sullivan, he's our last tweet for today. He wants to a little context on Bart Giamatti. He wants you to set it up here before we play it out.
Yeah. All right. My thanks to you, Taylor. I always love these conversations before and after the show, during the show. And thank you so much for all the work that you do.
Thank you, sir. You are the among the hardest working podcaster at ESPN. Maybe. I'll throw that title around for you. Thank you, Buster.
I appreciate that. My thanks today to Paul Ambikides, to Todd Radom, Sarah Langs. All three of those folks are a really big part of this podcast. And as we talk about every time, you know, the end of every year, our annual tradition is to end with Bart Giamatti's reading of his own work, Green Fields of the Mind. He was a baseball commissioner for too short of a time. He was the commissioner. He was a former president of Yale. He was the commissioner when Pete Rose, that scandal broke, and he was investigated. And I will always believe that Giamatti really had his health affected by the idea that he was going to put the all-time hit king on a ban list of some kind. I think this whole situation absolutely broke his heart. And about a week after Pete Rose was banned from baseball, Bart Giamatti suffered a fatal heart attack. Here is Bart Giamatti's Green Fields of the Mind.
But Bart, of course, is a Renaissance man, and that means that he is also a Red Sox fan.
He wrote a classic piece, actually, one of his great pieces called The Green Fields of the Mind. Please welcome him back, Commissioner Bart Giamatti.
This little piece was originally written one afternoon as the class notes for the class of 1960 in Yale College. I was the class secretary. I had absolutely nothing to say about my classmates. I wrote what you're about to hear. It was properly and immediately rejected by the Yale Alumni Magazine on the grounds that it was completely irrelevant to the purpose of the class notes. I accepted the judgment cheerfully. And then, when unaccountably 2 months later I became president, the Alumni Magazine reprinted it. Remarkable. But not as class notes. It breaks your heart. It is designed to break your heart. The game begins in the spring when everything else begins again, and it blossoms in the summer, filling the afternoons and evenings, and then as soon as the chill rains come, it stops and leaves you to face the fall alone. You count on it, rely on it to buffer the passage of time, to keep the memory of sunshine and high skies alive, and then just when the days are all twilight, when you need it most, it stops. Today, October 2nd, a Sunday of rain and broken branches and leaf-clogged drains and slick streets, it stopped, and summer was gone. Somehow the summer seemed to slip by faster this time. Maybe it wasn't this summer, but all the summers that in this, my 40th summer, slip by so fast. There comes a time when every summer will have something of autumn in it. Whatever the reason, it seemed to me that I was investing more and more in baseball, making the game do more of the work that keeps time fat and slow and lazy. I was counting on the game's deep patterns, three strikes, three outs, three times, three innings, and its deepest impulse to go out and back, to leave and to return home, to set the order of the day and to organize the daylight. I wrote a few things this past summer, the summer that did not last, nothing grand, but some things, and yet that work was just camouflage. The real activity was done with the radio, not the all-seeing, all-falsifying television. And was the playing of the game in the only place it will last, the enclosed green field of the mind. There in that warm, bright place, what the old poet called mutability, does not so quickly come. But out here, on Sunday, October 2nd, when it rains all day, the immutability never loses. She was in the crowd at Fenway yesterday, a gray day full of bluster and contradiction. When the Red Sox came up in the last of the ninth, trailing Baltimore 8-5, well, the Yankees, rain delayed against Detroit, needing only to win one or have Boston lose one to win it all, sat in New York washing down cold cuts with beer and watching the Boston game. Boston had won two, the Yankees had lost two, and suddenly it seemed as if the whole season might go to the last day or beyond, except here was Boston losing 8-5, while New York sat in its family room and put up its feet. Lynn, both ankles hurting now as they had in July, hits a single down the right field line. The crowd stirs. It's on its feet. Hobson, third baseman, former Bear Bryant quarterback, strong, quiet, over 100 RBIs, goes for three breaking balls and is out. The goddess smiles and encourages her agent, a canny journeyman named Nelson Bryles. Now comes the pinch hitter, Bernie Carbo, one-time Rook of the Year, erratic, quick, a shade too handsome, so laid back he's always in his soul, stretched out in the tall grass, one arm under his head, watching the clouds and laughing. Now he looks over some low stuff unworthy of him, and then, uncoiling, sends one out. Straight on a rising line, over the center field wall, no cheap Fenway shot, but all of it, the physics as elegant as the arc the ball describes. New England is on its feet, roaring. The summer will not pass. Roaring, they recall the evening late and cold in 1975, the sixth game of the World Series. Perhaps the greatest baseball game played in the last 50 years. When Carbo, loose and easy, had uncoiled to tie the game that Fisk would win. It is now 8-7, one out, and school will never start, rain will never come, sun will warm the back of your neck forever. Now Bailey, picked up from the National League recently, big arms, heavy gut experience, new to the league and the club, fouls off too, and then checking, tentative, a big man off balance, he pops a soft liner to the first baseman. It is suddenly darker and later. And the announcer doing the game coast to coast, the New Yorker who works for a New York television station, sounds relieved. His little world, well lit, hot combed, split second timed, has no capacity to absorb this much gritty, grainy, contrary reality. Cox swings a bat, stretches his long arm, bends his back. The rookie from Pawtucket who broke in 2 weeks ago with a record 6 straight hits. The kid drafted ahead of Freddie Lynn. Rangy, smooth, cool. The count runs 2-2, and Cox swings the ball beginning toward the mound, and then in a jaunty, wayward dance, skips past Bryles, fainting to the right, skimming the last of the grass, finding the dirt, moving now like some small, purposeful marine creature negotiating the green deep, easily avoiding the jagged rock of second base and traveling steady and straight now out into the dark, silent recesses of center field. Well, the aisles are jammed, the place is on its feet, the wrappers, the program, the Coke cups and peanut shells, the detritus of an afternoon, the anxieties, the things that have to be done tomorrow, the regrets about yesterday, the accumulation of a summer, all forgotten, while hope, the anchor, bites and takes hold, where a moment before it had seemed we would be swept out with the tide. Rice is up. Rice, who Aaron had said was the only one he'd seen with the ability to break his records. Rice, the best clutch hitter on the club with the best slugging percentage in the league. Rice, so quick and strong, he once checked his swing halfway through and snapped the bat in two. Rice, the hammer of God, sent to scourge the Yankees. The sound was overwhelming. Fathers pounded their sons in the back. Cars pulled off the road. Households froze. New England exulted in its blessedness and roared its thanks for all good things for Rice and for a summer stretching halfway through October. Bryles threw, Rice swung, and it was over. One pitch, fly to center, and it stopped. Summer died in New England, and like rain sliding off a roof, the crowd slipped out of Fenway quickly, with only a steady murmur of concern for the drive ahead remaining of the roar. Dame mutability had turned the seasons and translated hope to memory once again. And once again, she had used baseball, our best invention to stay change, to bring change on. That is why it breaks my heart, that game. Not because in New York they could win, because Boston lost, and that there's a rough justice and a reminder to the Yankees of how slight and fragile are the circumstances that exalt one group of human beings over another. It breaks my heart because it was meant to. Because it was meant to foster in me again the illusion that there was something abiding, some pattern and some impulse that could come together to make a reality that would resist the corrosion. And because after it had fostered again that most hungered for illusion, the game was meant to stop and betray precisely what it promised. Now, of course, there are those who learn after the first few times. They grow out of sports. And there are others who are born with the wisdom to know that nothing lasts. These are the truly tough among us, the ones who can live without illusion or without even the hope of illusion. But I am not that grown up or up to date. I am a simpler creature, tied to more primitive patterns and cycles. I need to think something lasts forever. And it might as well be that state of being that is a game. It might as well be that in a green field, in the sun. Thank you.